remember, our class today is devoted to Heichalot literature. The word Heichalot is derived from the word Heichal. Heichal special temple. Now everyone knows that Heichal is the most common word for the word temple in the Bible. The word Heichalot naturally is relating to the plural of the word temple. The question which is interesting for us is what is the nature of this literature, when it was written, by whom, why? The answer is, it's a conundrum. It's very interesting, but it's absolutely unclear. I've been spending 20 years at least in studying this literature, and after 20 years I'm happy to say it's a conundrum. It's an enigma. We don't really know who wrote it, why it has been written, why it has been published, but we have a fact that there is a body of literature which is called Sifrut HaHeichalot, or Heichalot literature, or Heichalot v'Merkaza. The very name of the literature is very suggestive. Heichalot, as I said, is plural of temple. Merkava is a chariot. We have been talking about it. The word Merkava immediately sends us to Ezekiel on one side, because Ezekiel's vision is Chazon Merkava, the vision of the Merkava, and it sends us immediately and inevitably to the priestly area, to the priestly vicinity. Now, of course, it's not only priests who are interested in Heichalot and in Merkava, in heavenly temples and in chariots, but priests have particular interest in it. Particular interest, especially after they have no temple. Now the one thing, there are about three, four things we can say in a positive way about this literature. Number one, it has been written after the destruction of the temple. That much we know very well because of the name of the heroes. This literature has three major heroes, two human and one inhuman. Now, the two human heroes are depicted in this literature as transcending borders of time and space. The two human heroes are very well known to you. That's Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael. That's part of the conundrum. Is that the same Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael that we're familiar with from the Mishnah? Is that another group of people who ascribe themselves those names? Is this literature a real relating of what has been going on? Is that pseudo-epigrapha? Now this is very interesting, because as I said, this literature is a conundrum. But before that one moment, I said there are three heroes. One is Rabbi Akiva, one is Rabbi Ishmael, and one is Hanok Matatah. Now that again exactly takes us back to where we have been in the last 2 weeks, in the Christian literature of Qumran. I want to make it very clear. We are talking on two different periods. What we've been doing so far is before the Common Era. Whether it's this or it's that, we have been before the Common Era, claiming that the literature that has been found in Qumran is the literature of the priestly sons of Tzadok. That's the way that they are describing themselves, that's the way they're relating themselves, they are preoccupied with priests, with angels, with heavenly palaces and so on. But it's all before the Common Era. That means there is a temple in Jerusalem. They consider it desecrated, desecrated temple. They consider it an unworthy temple. So they create temple in heaven. We understand the mechanism, we understand the reason, we understand where they're coming from, because we have plenty of literature. As I said, we have 950 documents that assure us what has been going on. We understand it very well, where, who are the people, how they see themselves, where they're coming from. We don't have anything like it in the Heichalot literature, because in the case of the Heichalot literature, we have only the literature. Now we have to ask those questions that I said. Is that the same Rabbi Akiva? Is that a pseudo-graphic Rabbi Akiva? Is that the same Rabbi Ishmael? Is that a pseudo-graphic Rabbi Ishmael? Yes.
Well, we see the same story
that
there
is
in
Nehalot and Yeah, they are.
Amulet, so
no, it's not. Anyhow, there are three possible answers. One is, yes, defend Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael in the Mishnah, and the Talmud will defend Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael in Mechalot Eshoter. That's definitely a possible answer. However, and one may say just as well, they are not the same. They are pseudo-epigraphic ascriptions of the Mishnah and the Talmud material. If that is the case, we should ask, do we have such a pseudo-epigraphy in other cases? When do we have pseudo-epigraphy? When we say pseudo-epigraphy, a name which is not really yours, name is name, pseudo-name. When you ascribe yourself a name which is not yourself. If I would say that I'm Abraham Lincoln, that would be pseudo-epigraphy, because I'm not. However, usually, one would not ascribe to himself a name of a person who lives in his own vicinity. One would say, I would take a name from the past. That's the case with a great deal of literature. We have Ascension of Isaiah, Ezra the Fourth, Baruch the Second, Jeremiah the Third. If there was a tradition of ascribing names to people who are not the real authors, but it was always referring to the biblical past. All the pseudepigrapha that we have in late antiquity and early common era usually is working around the premises of biblical writing. Thus we have 1st, 2nd and 3rd Enoch, the Testament of Abraham, the Ascension of Moshe, the Ascension of Isaiah. Without getting into details who wrote it and why, we are allowed to say that there is a vast literature that nominates itself with biblical heroes for that reason or another reason. The literature that we are talking here is a different one, because it is relating itself in first person to Akiva and Ishmael. If Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael are the same heroes of the Mishnah and the Talmud, we have to ask them, what's the relation between those two literatures? Are they relating to the same? The answer is not. In a way, we may say that while the Mishnah and the Talmud are relating to legal questions, to daily concerns, to legal adaptations of the biblical code into a day-to-day work, we can say absolutely that the Heichalot literature is not concerned in any daily concern. They are concerned in heavenly depiction. So we may say, as I said, it's only a speculation, we are allowed to say that those are the same heroes, that in the day Rabbi Akiva was thinking and teaching the Mishnah, and at night he has been experiencing and thinking and ascending into the Heichalot. But this is not a positive notion. It all might be a literary construct. But whether it is a historical contention or a late literary construct, and both are possibilities, we have to ask why. Because as an author, when you choose a hero, you ascribe meaning to it. When Melville writes Moby Dick, when he calls the hero Ishmael, that's the reason that I chose Moby Dick, because it's Rabbi Ishmael and Ishmael, this is not an incident. He has the whole biblical tradition about Ishmael in his mind when he is choosing this name. When the Heichalot literature writers claim that Rabbi Ishmael is the main hero or Rabbi Akiva is the main hero, they certainly rely on the credibility, the importance, the innovativeness of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael as they are known to us in the literary tradition. But now we are coming to the next point. I say that one thing we can say for sure is that it has been written after the common era, because of the names of the heroes. This couldn't have been written before. The next thing we can say in an absolutely positive way, that this is a written tradition. And if that's a written tradition, that puts it exactly in the opposite of the oral tradition. Because in the time that we are talking, the Mishnah is not written. The Talmud is not written. It is all an oral compass. Now, the question when Torah Shebe'al Peh turns into Torah Shebichtav is a subject of a great debate. Now, most scholars think that it was oral. The word Tanah is from Lishno, which is to say orally, to memorize. Scholars as great as Sol Lieberman, as Shraga Abramson, as Epstein, suggest that it hasn't been written down until quite late. We used to think that Rabbi Yehuda still wrote it. That's a mistake. He did not write it. He edited it orally, and everybody was in charge on memorizing of a certain Seder of the Mishnah. Now, for us who are people who are relying on reading and writing in the most natural way, it's hard to depict our whole literature was studied orally, but that was the case, and that has been proven in various scholarly studies, that in the first few centuries of the Common Era, it was oral teaching, it was not written teaching. People may have written down to themselves short notes for memory, but it was not edited in a written way. It was oral law as it is said. Now, at the very same time, Heichalot literature is absolutely a written thing. It's not an oral thing. It's a written genre, and it is not an oral genre. So we have here a complication. We have here the heroes of the oral law being presented as the mystical heroes of the written law. The heroes of the oral law are presented as the heroes of the mystical law, which is written. Now we have in the background a great written language. The Bible is a written thing. It's not an oral thing. The Bible has been written in the course of the first millennia before the Common Era in a definite written way. And as we know, in more than one version or more than one recension, but they were all written. The Septuagint is written, the Qumran version is written, the tradition is written. That's written. However, at the same time we have Torah, Shebe'alpeh, after the Common Era. I repeat, after the Common Era. And here we have the Chayot, which is written. So this and that are written, that is all. We are bordering here on the questions of canonicity, of exclusion, of inclusion. We are in a period with great tension. What would be in, what would be out? The Mishnah and the Talmud are relating various traditions about disputes among the sages. What would be included in this last edition of the Bible? We should know that while the Bible was has been written in the course of the whole millennium before the Common Era, it was edited in a final recension only after the Common Era. The editors are the same. So the editorial work of deciding what would be included and what would be excluded is a sacred decision, not priestly decision. It was written and it was kept by the priest before the Common Era. It was edited and with the idea of a canon after the Common Era. The editors were the sages. How do we know this? In the Mishnah we have disputes and in the Talmud what would be in and what would be out. We know that Rabbi Akiva had to convince the sages that Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kodeshim, and there were some who decided that Shir HaShirim should be excluded. We know that Ezekiel was from Gemara Shabbat with Gimel. We know that a certain sage by the name of Hananiah ben Chizkiyah is praised highly for the fact that he took upon himself to expound the different professions between the priestly code of Pentateuch and the priestly laws in Ezekiel, so they would be able to include it in the canon. It means that there were some who suggested, let's not include Ezekiel. So, they did not write anything, but they edited. Edited is to decide what's in and what's out. The very word editing is the meaning often is to decide what is in and what is out. The editorial retention has been done after the common era by the sages, and not incidentally, in a very decided way, in a very programmatic way. Because the reason for the editorial job was to claim that there are no more biblical books. Only the sages claim that there is no more divine revelation and there are no more biblical writings. We have to understand this point because this is of great importance. Those who did this canonical prophet were those who said that there is no more prophecy, there is no more direct divine revelation, thus there are no more holy books. At the very same time, there were people of different groups who said, oh, definitely there is more prophecy, definitely there are more holy books, definitely one should consider other writings. Now, if there is only one thing I want you to remember out of all of this, is the fact that there is no such a thing as one unanimous Judaism. There are Judaisms in plural. There are various parties. There are various heroes. There are various programs. There are various traditions. Not one. It's a mistake to think that there is only one. It's a common mistake. However, it's a mistake. Why is that? Because at the very same time, we have people who say, all of them were born Jews. We have people who say, yes, there is an ongoing prophecy. Others say, there is no more prophecy. There are people who claim, there are holy books written. Others say, there is no holy book written. Now, the argument of the period is whether one can claim that more books are written, or whether one should say, no more books ever would be written of this kind. So canonizing the Bible means no more books of that kind will be written. It's impossible. But then the next question. Why should we say that what was going on in the course of the whole millennia, things like direct divine revelation, like prophecy, like divine law, why should we say it ends? When is the moment that it ended? Why it has been ended? Why what was considered to be absolutely reasonable and definitely a common denominator for the Jewish people in the course of a whole millennia, why it was ended? Why anybody can say that prophecy ended? And it may just say, why? Maybe because there are claimers of an ongoing prophetic law that they disagree with, that they are afraid of. For instance, who would be in the first century of the Common Era who is claiming for all
the Christians?
The Christians, for instance. But let us remember that until the end of the first century, they had no idea that they are Christians. They are Jews. All of them were born Jews. They don't know that they are Christians, nor do they call themselves Christians. In the first century, there are only Jews. Yehoshua min Nazareth is Yehoshua the son of Miriam, and Yosef or only the son of Miriam, and a Jewish boy who was born here and there. Yohanan is a Jewish boy. Shaul HaParsi, later all known as Paulus, is a Jew. All of them are Jews. This group of Jews claiming that they have a new prophecy of Messianic times. There were many Jews who had Messianic prophecy. Some we know about, some we know less. But we must remember that the editorial work has been going on with a great deal of commotion. Now let's take a very quick look on the turn of the century. What's going on? Who are the powers that are active? Not political powers, but each one of those political powers also has cultural contentions, religious demands, religious awareness. There is not one. First of all, it will take, according to political order, until the first century, before the Common Era, there were Hashmonaim, as far as political power. Okay? They might not be great religious leaders, but they were definitely great political power until the year 37 before the Common Era. Okay? They are there. They have been in from 162 BCE until 37. And well, the last Hasmonean king, Antigono, was getting murdered by his successor, Probus. Herod was a nomination of the Romans, and the last Hasmonean king, Antigono, was being assassinated with all the rest of the family to the bone by Herod. So we have political power of Herod on the one side and Hasmonean on the other side. Although they have been assassinated and deposed and destroyed, they have been around. They had their own ideas, their own preferences, their own people. People who were identifying with them for one reason or another. We have Herod. Who else do we have here? We have the Prussians, who are known to invite Demetrius III to come over to fight against Johann Wolfgang. Now, so you won't be having to remember all of that. I prepared for you a historical... Take a quick look. Now, we are not going to look in the first page because that starts with the Egyptians in the 13th century. You will look on it later. But please turn on the page to the third page, okay? I want you to look very carefully on all of that. That is the history before the Common Era. But take one look here, please. Look. On this side, it's the great historical period. Egyptians, Assyrians, Babylonian, Persian, and so on. On that side are the books that have been written, as far as we know, according to the respective period. So, if the Assyrian period is from 732 to 597, the books of Jeremiah and Amos and Genesis were written in this period. However, now it's not our concern, the early centuries of the millennium, we just want to be forward to the end. Take a look on the fourth page, okay? I'm reading in a very quick way, without details. You'll have time to look on it. All the dates are given, the names are given. It's important to understand that Jewish history was never taking place in a vacuum. It's always taking place in relation to the high power, which is ruling, whether it's the Seleucians, whether it is the Egyptians, whether it's the Persians, the Assyrians. We are part of a political situation and we are relating to what's going on. We want to look for a second on what's going on in the turn of the century.
You know, 1,000 years from now.
I'm sorry?
1,000 years from now, they'll say that Israel never had an independence in 1948. They'll say it was part of American imperialism.
Well, that's not quite so, because we can say that in the United Nations in 1947, there has been a declaration of the independence of the State of Israel, because that's a fact attested by numerous listeners, okay? There is a difference between what one may think and between what is attested by documentation. So, in every period, our political life and cultural life were much affected by what has been going on by the political power available. We want to look in the very end of this page. We're starting on the turn of the century, of the first century, okay? In between 104 and 103 BCE, Eudarius Sobolus, son of Johann Hyrcanus, is inheriting him and nominating himself as a king, killing his brother, holding his mother in prison where she died. This Hasmonean family were really notorious. Each one of them was either killing or assassinating, and first and foremost his own family. Now, Alexander Yanai, his brother, becomes the high priest and the king. So, Yeldaris Sobolos is ruling, and his brother is inheriting him in the turn of the century between 103 and 72. In 103, the same time that Alexander Yanai is taking power, Cleopatra III is ruling Egypt, and the children of the high priest, the one that flee to Egypt, Onias IV, Ananias and Sisias, are prominent generals in Cleopatra's army. Ananias declined an offer to attack Jerusalem and reclaim the high priesthood of the Onias family. We should remember that the Beth Onyo in Egypt is a sect. Beth Onyo in Egypt and Bnei Tzadok in Jerusalem and Qumran and the vicinity in the area. We are talking on the first century before the Commonwealth. As the decade between 90 and 83, there is a civil war in Judea. There wasn't a moment of quiet. There was a civil war. The Pharisees, now we know that they are political power. They're not only small churches. That's the first time that we know that they are strong political power. What do they do? First of all, they reject the Hasmoneans to the bone. And they call the Pharisees fighting against Alexander Yanai, rejecting him as a high priest, inviting Demetrius III to help them against Alexander. Alexander Yanai is reported to kill 800 of the Pharisees or 8,000 as a punishment. Now, we don't know about the exact number, whether it is 800 or 8,000. The 800 sounds bad enough. But we know that the Kurushim and the Hashmonaim are in very bad terms. They hate this group called Kurushim and this group called Hashmonaim, now in the days of Alexander Yanai. They are in such bad terms that the Pharisees are calling to the Seleucian emperor, Demetrius III, to come to their help to destroy him. They consider him an evil king, an unworthy person. It's not a common thing that Jewish power would cause an external political power to invade the land in order to depose it. But they did it. And that has never been forgotten. They never forgot it, neither they nor him. As I said, the Hashmonaim are in power until 37 before the Common Era. They never forgot, even that after Alexander Yanai, that the Kurushim, the Pharisees, that would be later on called the Sages or the Rabbis, called Demetrius III, the Seleucian king, to help. Okay. So when I say that there has been a lot of commotion, that's an example.
Did he come down?
Well, this is quite succeed, the whole thing. He tried, but the Hasmoneans were very powerful. They were not powerless. Alexander had the upper hand. We are told that he hung 800 of them. However, in 76, he passed away. Then, when he passed away, they had a chance. His wife, who was much smarter than her husband, which is always usually the case in English families and in others, her name is Shlomit or Shlomtzion Alexandra. She's called in three names. Saloma Shlomtzion, which is her Jewish name, Shlomtzion, or Alexandra. Alexandra is like the wife of Alexander. Alexander's wife becomes the ruling queen after his death. She's giving legal authorities to the Pharisees. He hated them because they betrayed him. She said, we don't want more and more, we want peace. She is drawing the Pharisees closer instead of further. And they remember that too. They're praising her. They say that Shlomtzion was a great person. Her son Yohanan Hyrcanus II becomes a high priest. She is the queen. He is nominated as a high priest. Between 67 to 64, Aristobulus II, Shlomtzion's second son, fights against his brother Yohanan Hyrcanus. Jewish notables fled Jerusalem and celebrate Passover in Egypt. When I say that in the first century BC this was very rough and hard, I'll take an example. The two children of the queen are fighting each other, aiming to kill each other, because why? They don't want to be the king after she would pass away. In 65, Johann Hortonus was besieging his brother Aristobulus in the temple. In 63, the Romans took over. That's a change. In 63, regardless of all what's going on in Jerusalem, the Romans are fighting against Egypt and against Syria, and they take over Israel. Not on any religious ground, only on political ground, because this is the way between Syria and Egypt. The Romans are taking over, and the Roman period starts. The Hellenistic period ends right here, because the Romans are taking over the Seleucid rule. Romans take over of Judea. Pontius, the Roman marshal, grants the leadership of the people and the high priesthood to John Hyrcanus II and conquers Jerusalem from his brother Aristobulus. So now the foreign power is the Romans, but the Hasmonean family continues with their inner assassinations of brothers, mothers, fathers, and so on and so forth. Between 57 to 55, Aristobulus and his sons try to rebel against Rome. Pontius' supporters kill Aristobulus. Hyrcanus and his friend Antipatris the Edomite support Pontius and Julius Caesar in Egypt. In 45, Julius Caesar introduced the Julian Roman calendar of 365 days. The calendar is imposed on the Roman Empire. Now, the solar calendar is imposed on the Empire, while before it was the Seleucid lunar calendar. At 44, Herod, son of Antipater, governor of Galilee, supports the Romans. Now, Antipater was a friend of the Hasmonean family. His child Herod wants to become the king. And Herod understands that the new power is the Romans. He supports them. Still in the year 40, Antigonus, son of Aristobulus II, is nominated by the Parthians who invaded the land of Israel to a king, and he is fighting against the Roman rule. Herod is escaping to Rome. So we have now two ruling families. One is running to Rome, one is in Jerusalem. The one who fled to Rome would win. At 37, Herod is nominated by the Roman rulers to be the king of Judea. At 37, end of the Hasmonean dynasty. Antigonus is executed. Now you can understand that the way that Herod came to power, with the bloodshed of fighting and wars and so on, left a scar on numerous people. The Hasmonean way of life left scars on numerous people. The faces are there. So when one talks on the Pharisees, don't think only on Mishnah and Talmud. Think on where they're all coming from. There is a very strong political commotion in the first century before the Common Era. Hasmonaim, Ushim, Herod, Roman, Seleucid, they're all there. It's very, very hard. There is a spot. There is one other group, the Hanukkah. They have no political power. The only thing they do, they write, they pray, they build heavenly temples because they have no earthly temples. The same people who are the Hasmonean assassinators are the high priests in the temple. So when they say that the Mikdash is in a Chulal, when they say that the temple is desecrated, they have plenty of reasons to say that. We're talking in the first century before the Common Era, when the Hasmonaim who are assassinating their brothers, their mothers, their fathers are officiating. They consider the temple to be utterly desecrated because those people who are military leaders are also officiating the high priest. Now, among them, there might be here and there a moment of mercy or a year of good doing, but in general, the Hasmonean period from 152, when Jonathan is officiating as high priest, until 37, when Antigonus is executed, in all that time, they are the only high priest. There is no other high priest. So there is no Tzadokim Kohanim. This is a common mistake. People think that there were high priests Tzadokim. Nothing like that. The only Kohanim, high priest, in this long period from the second, from the midst of the 7th century BC until the 37th BC, there is no Kohanim So think in the high sources, only hash monaim. You can imagine what are the opinions of the sages on the temple and on the high priesthood. You can imagine what are the opinions of the great Tzaddok on what's going on in the temple. All of this is informing the situation. Now there is one book, this book, who is having a library, who is continuing to write, who is arguing for a different order. They have no political power, and I will say time and again, they are writing, they are not planning anything, they have no political power of any kind. When Herod comes to power, at 37, he is not our first family, there is already, he is a king, but he never claims that he is a high priest. He needs to bring priests. What are his options? He cannot get the ruling Hasmonean period. He killed them all. There is no high priest available from the Hasmoneans. They all have been assassinated. He certainly has no intention to call back the ancient order of the Bnei Tzaddok. Why does he need the competing power? That's the last thing in his mind. Nor would they serve under him, because he's not from Beth Avil, he's not from the tribe of Judah. He is not according to their perception of what a king should be. He is looking around for high priests. He is taking, he is importing priests from abroad. He is bringing priests from unknown origins, from less than elitistic circles. He wants marginal priests to officiate. He wants to build a beautiful temple, a greater temple and all that, which would glorify him, not the ancient priesthood. So, on this background, we should understand what the sages are saying on priests and what the priests are saying on the other priests. So now, we have 100 years, that's all, between 37 BC until 70 CE, when the temple is destroyed. In these 100 years, the sages are forming, the Herodian power is taking in the upper hand, but all of that is in the background. Nobody forgot those words. They were what was going on. Now, the Romans capture Egypt in 30 BC. In 20 BC, the Augustus ordered confiscation of all temple land through Egypt, causing rapid decline of all temples, Onias temple included. Now the Onias temple, in that formula, has been functioning for now about 170 years. It has been a well-established place. That power center of the Bnei Chonyot, Bnei Tzaddok, outside of the land of Israel. They are officiating there. They create there. Now remember, for one thing, when we say, when we talk on the Mishnah, we think on the land of Israel idea, the land of Israel scholarship. But in the very same time, we have numerous new centers outside of the land. In Egypt, there is a great Jewish community. Philo is a representative of it. Bnei Chonyo is representative of it. There are numerous Jews in Egypt in the first century before the Common Era. They have their own centers, they have their own ideas, they have their own leading powers, they have their own books. They have their contention on the holiness of the Greek language alongside the Jewish other languages, Hebrew and Aramaic. We have a multicultural and polyglottic situation. Gloss is a language, polyglot is when multilingual phenomenon is taking place. The Jews are writing in Hebrew, in Aramaic, and in Greek. They are speaking to each other in those three languages, but this book called Koranim Bnei Tzaddok are writing nearly only in Hebrew. This book, Beit Chonyot, is writing in Greek. Therefore, the Pharisees are not writing at all. Okay? I want you to pay attention to the following. The priests in Israel and the priests in Egypt are writing and writing and writing, in Greek or in Hebrew. The Pharisees are not writing at all. They invented a oral law. But it varies in very many aspects. It's against the ongoing Christian values. They want to fashion a new idea, a new point. First of all, it is divorced from the truth. They don't want to claim Christian legitimacy, which is always based on books. They don't want Christian scripture as the base of their legitimacy. They want oral law. That means, seriously, we do not write. We expound, we talk, we teach, we explore, we do numerous things, all of them entirely new, and all of them are very vibrant, are very interesting, are very meaningful, but they are not Christian and they are not Christian. No, the writing is exclusively Christian. We don't have a single text not written by Christ in this period. We don't have anything written by anybody who is not a Christ. The Christ of us, the sages do not write. Their heroes are not writing heroes, and this is a decision. This is a position. This is a decision. Now, what do they do about the written law? They wish to canonize. They wish to say that the end of the written course. Who would disagree with this? Those books would say, we have been writing always. Why would you tell us not to write? We have been writing always under divine inspiration, or copying what has been written under divine inspiration. You cannot tell us that divine inspiration is open. They keep the highest degree of purity. They keep the highest degree of spiritual concentration. They are writing, they are searching for prophetic revelation. They are an ongoing scriptural phenomenon. The sages say, no fighting. If we could do like that, let's say that this is a pen, they would say, no pen is needed. Yes. I can say
that Ecclesiastes or other thought, there is no end to many books. And so that passage in Kohelet, which was much earlier, to every account, this is
I have no answer to that, because the only thing is, of course, within the biblical library, there are numerous books, not all of them Christian, there are others which are not Christian, but there is certainly criticism on the Christian book. The major part of the Bible is of course the Old Testament, but not exclusive. However, there are probably more than one kind of criticism about the books, and the sages also have things to say about it, and Kohelet says about it, but that's what this group has been doing for years and years, for a whole millennium. For them, keeping libraries, keeping scriptures, relying on literary sources, is the source of their legitimacy. Let me remind you something which is very obvious in English. The connection between author and authority. When you are an author, you have an authority. In Aramaic, samcha ve musnach ve samchu. Had samcha is the authority that we are relying on. Musnach is author. Samchut is authority. Authority on scripture is what the priest always says. The sages say our authority is not from scripture. Our authority is entirely different. So for them, that's a different world of authority. We have to understand that's a principal position. It's not an incident. This is a principal position. Because there is a big party with ancient laws, with ancient authority, relying on scripture. And the new party, and they are definitely new in relation to the older churches, the new party says, our authority is the oral law, the oral exposition, the oral exploration. And what is this oral thing? The infinite possibilities of exploring every meaning of the written scripture. The infinite possibility of understanding, adapting, interpreting, comparing. Then he said, the scriptures are not yours, they are also ours, only with one difference. We've explored them, interpreted them, worked with them, changed, adapted, and so on. While you say that you are only recording them. There is a difference here. This practical position is, this group says, we are taking the sovereignty and the freedom to explore, interpret, analyze, compare, work with. That's why they are called Purushim. The word Purushim is derived from Lefarish, not the usual people think from Lefarish. It has nothing to do with Lefarish Nasibu, Halila, the opposite. It's from Lefarish, like Dorshim, Porshim, Drushim, Purushim, the same structure. Lidrosh, the Lefarish, Lidrosh is to expand, Lefarish is to exegesis. Let's have to interpret hermeneutics. All those words are what the Purushim are. It is based on human sovereignty. And let it be very clear. All what they are doing is based on human sovereignty. All what they are doing, as far as they are just the priests, all what the priests are doing is based in their consciousness on divine. And so,
I'm sorry? The Purushim based their authority on divine revelation, but it wasn't a written, it was an oral divine revelation.
No, they do not.
Allah Kama Shem is denied.
That's much later. They do not base their authority on direct divine revelation. They don't. They base themselves on human sovereignty. More than anything is that the story, the famous story of the water last night, you know, the dispute between Rabbi Eliezer and the rest of the sages. Now, what is it about? Of course they're not denying anything. I didn't say they deny anything. They just don't create any more of it. That's what I want you to understand, the complexity of it. Of course they consecrate all this. They certainly consecrate the purpose, of course, it is holy. Only they say that there is no more of it. They decide on a moment where there is no more of it. Now, let's say that there are 24 books. In truth, as I said, there are 40. But let's say 24. There are 24 books. As far as the sages are concerned, there would not be a 25th book under no way. As far as the priests are concerned, there certainly would be 25 books. As we said, they have 950 documents. Different of them are copies of each other, but they have numerous documents, not only 24. Many of those documents could have been just as part of the 24 books with no problem at all. As I said time and again, the only difference between what could have been incorporated easily and has been left out is the sentence which starts HaShabbat HaRishonah BaRevi'i LaChodesh HaRishon. Any reference to the Torah character would make immediate exclusion any text which otherwise could have been perfectly sacred and beautiful and all that. So we do have two books. One is, let's say, in a present perfect situation. They continue to work. They copy the written scriptures, they record down the divine revelations, they consecrate it, they speak it, but they don't explore it. They don't expand it. They don't do legal exploration of it. They write whatever they believe is the ancient divine word or new divine revelation. They consider themselves to be the carriers of the divine inspiration, divine revelation, divine prophecy. Of course, not all of them. Singular among them has always was the case in the biblical period. But they, all of them are the keepers of the relation. Therefore, the Purushim certainly says we would choose among all that what is possible, what is available, what we can live with, and then we would canonize it, and we would not allow it to add to it anymore. That's the point that I want to make clear. It is an oral tradition, which later on could be said as halakha le Moshe Sinai. However, there is no halakha for Moses' day, because the first halakha is from other than the biblical Bible, is what we have after the Common Era, or in the last century before the Common Era. We don't have halakha which is equal time-wise to Genesis, or we don't have halakha which is equal to time-wise to Exodus or to Leviticus. All what we have is Exodus, Leviticus, and so on. The new kind of thinking, of interpreting, of exploring, of doing a complete revolution of it, is in the turn of the century. It is in the first and second century of the Common Era, the last end of the century before the Common Era, not earlier than that. The fact that later on we say Halakha Moshe Sinai is just a different thing. But practically, people who carry that, people who do that, is only in this end. Okay. Common.
Do we have any literature from Bethlehem?
Yes, books like Yosef and Busnat, and books like Hanoch Hasheni, most likely. I'm sorry? Yosef and Busnat is a sipur, it's like we call it today a rewritten Bible. They're talking now on the Yosef and Busnat is the story of legitimacy of the Mikdash Konyo. It's like in a very beautiful literary way how the authority has been passed from the Jerusalem temple to the Egyptian temple. Now, the point is not what each one of them wrote, all of them wrote, but the fact that there is numerous enemies, not one enemy. There is not only one group who is claiming credibility, authority, continuity, there are numerous. Let's say that this group wrote only one, they wrote more, but get a power, intellectual, religious, cultural, let's say that this group is continuing to run the political, cultural, religious focus. Let's say that this group does not fight, but they are standing together, they are creating another new way of relating to these forces. That group is not fight. They hired two authors to write for them, that's the and maybe the continuation of Yazon of the rest of people who write for them are propaganda. It's really a political propaganda, it's really true. However, we have also the other book which I did not mention yet, and then the what we call Yehudim Nasrin, Yehudim Meshichiim, Yehudim Meshichiim, which are right now not at all of our concern, only this group claims that the Messiah is very near. That it starts with the fact that they do like everything else. They don't drop any commandment, they don't do anything. They only claim the Messianic end is very near. Many people thought so, because of all the commotions, the Seleucians, the Romans and all that. Many people thought in the turn of the century that the Messianic era is very near. This group not only claimed it's very near, but found a hero to embody the Messianic idea. It started with Yohanan and it went on with Yeshua, but that group, by the end of the century, is leaving the greater Jewish body, so we would leave them aside. However, I want you to understand that there is no single group in their complexion, which again is not full one, it's only a partial one, which is unaware of the other group, which doesn't have a coalition opposition relations with the other group. All of that is going on together. Let's take one last look.
I'm
sorry? Well, they had very good answer for this. They said, Adonai lachem lachem v'atem tacharishim. They were relying on divine power to intervene for them. And they said that they are describing the Milchemet Bneot Nechoshet, the war of the sons of light against the sons of darkness, and they say it's all predetermined. Now they believe in a predetermination. They believe in a world that is all clear cut. Now let's take a look in this page where we said that there was a civil war between the Pharisees and Alexander Yanai at 76. Okay, we read all that, we read this page, and we want to turn for the last page of this collection, and I argue to read very carefully the whole entire 5 pages to get acquainted with what was going on in Jewish history. Yes?
What's the relationship between the management of the world and our own
Dokim? Well, the Dokim would be the name that the sages would call in the 1st and 2nd century of the Common Era people who were of Christian origin but not necessarily related to them directly. They would be associated with them but not necessarily associated with them. The Kohanim or Tzedokim or Bnei Tzedok are part of the society. The one thing which differentiates them other than anything else, what differentiates between Kohanim and Tzedokim? Only one major thing. They are based on what? Other than that, they are based on generality. They are by birth. You are Kohen by birth. You cannot dismiss them. They are vested group of aristocratic origin, of extra privileges and commitment. Anyone who was born with this group is part of it. Now, not anyone who was born with that group went with this group. This is the hardcore, those who believe that there is only one group. The Tzedokim are those who were living all over the country as Kohanim and Levim, who were ready to work together with whoever is in power. Therefore, the Bnei Tzedok were not ready to work together. They stepped out, they stayed inside. However, they share very many things. All the halakhic disputes between Tzedokim and Kohanim are well attested in the literature of that book. And what is the major dispute between Kohanim and Tzedokim? When is the date of the Omer? When is the date of Shavuot? What is the way that we should do the Torah? I mean, things which relate to the holy time or solar calendar and things which relate to the temple way of worship. All of those disputes are taking place when? Between 37 from the Herodian time until 70 when the temple is over. It's 100 years. Those who are in Jerusalem would dispute with those who are handling the temple. Because in these 100 years, only in these 100 years, between 37 to 70, we had all those groups working together. Because when the Hasmoneans stepped down, there's no more Hasmonean high priest, and the priest would be from various families, Bet Baitot, Bet Tzedok, Bet all the different 24 priests, and it could be a source of recruitment after the high family of Bnei Tzedok is not officiated. Now, in this period, the sages are putting together ideas, differentiation, principles, but the major difference between those two, take a look between this one and that one, between the Kohanim and Tzedokim. The Tzedokim are those who say there is only Torah Shebichtav. The Kohanim are those who say next to the Torah Shebichtav there is Torah Shebe'al-Peh. If we would translate it into our dictionary, we would say the Tzedokim say only scriptural legitimacy, only scriptural authority, only sacred scripture is the base of what we would do and what we won't do. The sages say, on top of those sacred scriptures, which we certainly share with you, on top of those sacred scriptures, we add various ideas. We add our expositions, our explorations, our legal things. We have numerous editions. All of them are oral, none of them are written. Later on, when it would be a disputed issue, they would say halakha l'Moshe m'Sinai. Then they would develop the idea that all the oral law has been transmitted alongside the written law from the days of Moses. Historically it's impossible and it's improbable, but that's the way they introduced. Now, we just want to take a look on the last five things. Philo is writing Egyptian Jewish history and culture in the 3rd century of the Common Era. I'm looking on the last page of the historical collection. At the year 70, the second temple is destroyed. There is no way to explain how traumatic and how tragic that thing was. Because while all those groups were disputing with each other, the temple was the center where religious life took place. The sages also operated in the temple. They were creating the deep village capacity. They were also working there. They took their own power outside of the priestly presence. But when the temple was destroyed, the whole ancient law of millennia and a half was sunken. At 74, now we are off the common era, Onias temple is destroyed according to Vespasian's order by Lupus the Protectus of Egypt. In between the years 80 and 90, Josephus is writing War of the Jews and Antiquity, which is a major source of what has been going on in the turn of the era. Between the years 50 and 100, the Gospels of the New Testament are written. So now we have this group of the Yehudim and Shekhin, who is also writing. Their group is writing, this group is writing, their group is writing. This group says no writing. The sages are not writing. Okay? Between the year 100 and 175, the Bible is canonized and edited by the sages. Between the years 200 and 220, the Mishnah is edited orally, not written. It is an oral. Now, when we understand all of this, we return to what we started with. Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael of the Halakhic literature are presented as writers, not as oral writers, but as writing writers. Now, here we come to the question, which I said is a conundrum. Who are they? Why they are doing what they are doing? With whom are they standing? Who wrote it? Why they wrote it? Now all kinds of things were taking place after the destruction of the temple. First of all, we need to find out the solution to all the functions that the temple was operating for atonement, for korbanot, for prayer, for high court, all the very things that the temple was the center of. All of them had been eradicated like by an earthquake. It was completely disappeared. Who would do what? Who would take over? Now who were the possible candidates? The people who could have been those who would take over would be the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the main Sadducees. The one who took over was this group, the Pharisees. It's not from any other reason, because they started by saying, Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek la'olam haba. They were inclusive. The sages that now would be called Chazal or Rabbanim or Tanaim, all of that, all those are synonym names. That's the group which was headed by not few priests, by the way. Quite a few of them were of priestly origin. Only they discarded entirely the priestly basis of Leviticus. Yohanan ben Zakkai is a priest. However, I mean, he is of priestly origin. But he doesn't claim any priestly prerogative. On the contrary, he leaves Jerusalem and he wants to establish Yahweh, where people are studying the oral law and doing an incredible thing. They make the substantial perception of holiness into nominal perception of holiness. Substantial is when there is a substantial difference between tahor and tameh. Nominal is when tahor and tameh is when I declare it is tahor or when I declare it is tameh. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, Shulchano shel Adam mitzbeach. Every house and every table could become as holy as an altar in the temple if I would consecrate it by blessing, by telling the blessing. Yochanan ben Zakkai suggests what hasn't been suggested earlier, that the very wording, the very blessing, the very utterance of the blessing, making a space into a sacred space. So it's not an inner sacredness which is inherited in anything. It's only the human consecration which makes something tahor or tameh. We won't go in detail into that, just for the time being, let's mark that the whole perception of sacredness is changing. Now it's not holy or profane, but imminent inheritance. States, which we would find example of, like, Lama Sefer Torah Metamei Chayadam. How can we say the divider which is so holy Metamei Chayadam? Why? Because we declare it to be Metamei Chayadam. It's not any Tum'ayim we call itself. It's only we declare it Metamei in order to defend it, so people won't touch it. So this whole course of thinking of sacredness and profanity by human declaration and not by inherent meaning is the course of thinking that the sages are promoting, along with many others. Now, on this background, we want to take a look on the kind of fighting that the sages are promoting or prohibiting. What we are told about Sifrut HaMerkabah, there are about 4 points of meeting between Heichalot literature and sages literature, whether oral or written. Number one is the fact that the hero of Sifrut HaHeichalot, Rabbi Ishmael, is described in Brachot, page 7a, as a person who is officiating at the high priest. We are told that b'sha'as Rabbi Ishmael is telling in first person, שנכנסתי להכתיר תורת בקודש הקודשים. I'm sorry? פעם אחת, if you remember you can take פעם אחת שנכנסתי פעם אחת שנכנסתי לפני ולפנים. Where is לפני ולפנים? That's קודש הקודשים. We are told in the Bible that לפני ולפנים is קודש הקודשים. רבי ישמעאל in the middle of the 2nd century is telling us פעם אחת שנכנסתי לפני ולפנים, once when I entered into the inner sanctum, להכתיר קטורת, to offer incense inside the inner sanctum, which means Yom Kippur, I saw a Katriel Yad Naisraot. I saw an angel or a divine entity known as a Katriel Adonai Tzvaot, and this divine entity, angelical divine, told me, Ishmael Bni Barchem, Ishmael my son, bless me. And Ishmael said, Shigmeru Rachamecha Al Tatecha, let your mercy overcome your anger, which I consider a very fine blessing. However, the point in concern for us is the following. How come Rabbi Ishmael can enter the Holy of Holies? Rabbi Ishmael was born in the middle of the 3rd century, at the latest, probably 50, 60 something. No way historically or chronologically he could officiate as a high priest in the temple that was destroyed between 68 to 70. No way he could officiate it. It's called Ishmael ben Elisha in both corpuses, in the Mishnah and the Talmud, and in Heichalot literature, this person is introduced as Ishmael ben Elisha. It's simple. I mean, in both cases, he cannot, according to historical order, officiate in the temple. So this is like a mystical segment that was incorporated into the Bible. And now that explains why he was chosen to be a hero of Heichalot literature, or vice versa, why he is described in the Bible. So, no, this is a mystical thing. Like, if he is serving in the Holy of Holies when there is no temple in Jerusalem, that's a mystical description. Because mysticism is defined by the fact that you can transcend borders. In reality, you cannot transcend borders. You can be a high priest in Jerusalem only until the year 70. If you are officiating, and since we know the day of his death, he was dying in 132, in the first third of the second century, he couldn't possibly have officiated in the temple.
I understand, but there are many times in the Talmud when history is a telescope, that is, you have characters from one age, and you guys know that. I'm wondering whether the intent, though, I'm not even sure there's a difference. Is there a difference whether the intent is metaphoric or whether it's mystical?
I'm not sure I can answer that because I don't know where is the distinction there. I just say there are two things we know. Historically, it's improbable and impossible. Mystically, it's possible. Metaphorically, I don't know. I'm not sure where we would put the metaphor.
But there's that may very well could have been written much a couple hundred years later. Very possible that
well, all of that, let's say, all of that is possible. However, I always claim we should never consider our predecessors less smart than ourselves. I'm quite sure they knew very well who was possibly living when the temple was existed and who was afterwards. It was quite easy to understand. However, we would not, I have no problem with anyone depicting sages' history according to different ways. One can understand it telescopically, one can understand it metaphorically, one can say that they were not interested in history. Probably all of that is true. However, the only thing that I wish to claim is that historically, if we're taking the sages' history according to the common demarcation, Rabbi Ishmael, who passed away in 132, could not have officiated in the temple that was destroyed in the year 70. Only that. Now, the next sage, who is the hero of the Halot literature, is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is even worse, because Rabbi Ishmael is a Kohen and Kohen Gadol according to the Talmudic theory. So at least it's possible that a person who is a Kohen, Kohen Gadol, can serve in a temple, whether historical or mystical. Rabbi Akiva is not a Kohen. That's definite. He's not from a priestly origin. However, he is associated with the very famous quotation, Arba'an Mosula Tarbet. Four entered paradise. Now, this word Tarbet that I mentioned before is a very important word for various reasons. From the Quran literature, we know that Tarbet is the synonym word for Garden of Eden. In Qumran, according to the Book of Jubilee, Garden of Eden and Paradise and the Inner Sanctum, the Holy of Holies, and Mount Zion and Mount Sinai are all paralleling to each other. They're all reflections of each other. They're all reflections of each other. For them, that's the essence of the holy place. In order to enter to the holy place on earth, you must be a priest. Apparently, according to that literature, in order to enter to the holy place in heaven or in the mystical vicinity, you don't necessarily have to be a priest. Because the story it starts with four entered Tarbet is not about priestly origin. It's about sages who are doing something that before has been done only by priests. So it's a new stage of mystical history. Now, if you recall in Hadidah, in the Mishnah, and in the Gemara, there is no explanation what they have been doing, why they have been doing what they have been doing. We don't know anything of it. But what we want to do very quickly now is to see how the Heichalot literature, recalling the
is there a critical edition of a Halot literature?
No, there is not an edition of a Halot literature.
Can the Yad and Polyot be seen as an anti Zenitha of Ulan?
Which one?
So these two forms of Enterprise are not Kalmanim. Would that be seen? Would that be seen as a
meaning or a I would not say that much yet. I'm sorry. Did that is
allowed to be anywhere beyond the confines of
before. For offers, you can give here or there. Okay, everyone has to have the Hanan of it, and everyone has to have a bank to the public. Okay? Collated in a synoptic edition, which means the seven major manuscripts of the Halot literature were collated together by Peter Schaeffer, edited in synoptic edition, that means one column next to other column next to other column, in a collection called Synopsis to a Halot literature. And the name of the editor is Peter Schaeffer. All of that is in Hebrew, of course, with the exclusion of the introduction on the left side, which is in German. However, in your in the syllabus, you'll find all the details of that. Parts of this collection have been put in critical editions. Different components of it, but we will talk about it in a couple of minutes. But I first want to read together those two chapters. Those of you who can read Hebrew, I'll read in the Hebrew. Those who wish to read the English translation, suggested under them. Ve'elu hen shenichnasu lapardes, Shimon ben Azai veShimon ben Doma veElisha ben Avia veRabbi Akiva ben Yosef. אמר להם רבי עקיבא, תיזהרו כשאתם מגיעים אצל אבני שיש טהור, אל תאמרו מים מים. בן עזאי הציץ בהיכל השישי, וראה זיו אבני שיש היו צלולות בהיכל ולא סבל גופו, ופתח פיו וכשעלה מים הללו מה טבעם ומת. הציץ ומת. בן זומא הציץ בזיו באבני השיש וצבר שהוא מים, וסבל בגופו שלא שעלם, אבל לא סבל דעתו, ונפגע. אלישע בן אבויה ירד וקיצץ את הנטיעות. אמרו כשירד אלישע למרכבה, ראה למטטרון שניתנה לו רשות שעה אחת ביום יושב ולכתוב זכויות של ישראל. אמר שנו חכמים למעלה אין עמידה ואין ישיבה. הרהר שמה שתי רשויות יש בשמיים. מיד הוציא למטטרון לחוץ לפרגות והיכו 60 פולטי אש. רבי עקיבא עלה בשלום וירד בשלום, ועליו הכתוב אומר, מושכני אחריך נרוצה, הביאני המלך הדרה. You can see that in the end of it it says synopsis לספרות ההיכלות, סעיף 672, and the השלמות בסוגריים are לפי סעיף 345. Now all of that, those of you who recall the Gemara in חגיגה בבלי, Mary Paul, it's quite close to it. There is no substantial difference. It goes back to the question, what's the relation between those two literary corpuses? Can we say that that's the same Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael? Or should we say that it's a different Rabbi Akiva and a different Rabbi Ishmael? Before we decide those things, we want to take a look on the second segment that we look at, the one which is called the Hanar Hazeh Matatron. Now, as I said, there are three major heroes of Sifrut HaEchalot, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Ishmael, which are historical figures according to the Mishnah and the Talmud, and according to the HaEchalot literature, and Matatron, which is an angelic figure, that's Hanoch ben Yered. We want to take a look on the way Hanoch ben Yered. Hanoch, that's from Genesis 5 to 24, yeah, the biblical Hanoch. Only אחרי הספירה, Hanoch ben Yered is called Hanoch Matatron, okay? Or called Na'ar. Why does he call Na'ar? Because he is the last entity who has been brought to heaven. While all the angels were created, as you were told, we were together in the first week of creation, the first day of creation. Hanoch was born as a human being in the seventh generation, and then he was taken to heaven in order to study the calendar according to the priestly law, and after he descended and taught the people, then he was taken up and he has been seated in heaven writing the rights of Israel. He's like the heavenly scribe. Now we want to see how in a halakhic literature after the common era, how this particular hero is now depicted. Ve'anan azeh Metatron malach tzarat amim. And this youth Metatron, angel of the present or angel of the happiness, עומד למעלה למעלה עומד למעלה למעלה במרום ומשמש לפני אש אוכלה אש. He is standing on high in heaven and serves before a fire devouring fire. זה מטטרון שר הפנים שנכתב באות אחת שבה נבראו שמיים וארץ וחתום בטבעת אהיה אשר אהיה. This is Metatron, angel of the presence or angel of the countenance, who is written in one letter that heaven and earth were created with, who is sealed with the ring of I am who I am. ונכתב בשבע אותות וב-22 אותיות וב-70 שמות וב-7 קדושות. He is written in 7 letters and in 22 letters and in 70 names and 7 sanctified benedictions. He is engraved on 12 stones and transcribed in 7 voices. ונכתב על 12 אבנים ונכתב בשבע קולות בשישה על רום שישה. וניתן בהדרי הדרים ופלאי קלעים ומלאכים אשר עמו באים וסובבים כתפי הכבוד. הם מצד אחד וחיות מצד אחר ושכינה על כתפי הכבוד באמצע. He's written in 7 letters and in 22 letters and in 7 names and 7 sanctified benedictions. He's engraved on 12 stones and transcribed in 7 voices, 6 above 6. Granted in glory of glory and wonder of wonders, and angels which stay with him are encircling the throne of glory. The angels are on one side, the holy creatures on the other side. The divine presence is on the throne in the middle, and one holy being, okay, I'm returning to the Hebrew, the Shekhinah Kitzeh Kvodo Ba'imta, V'chaya Achat, או ברוח אחת, עולה למעלה מן השרפים ויורדת על משכן הנער ששמו מטטרון ואומרת בקול גדול, קול דממה דקה, זך כתפי הכבוד. The divine presence is on the throne in the middle and one holy being ascends above the seraphim and descends on the dwelling of the youth named Metatron and says in a loud voice, voice of spirit, pure is the throne of glory. Okay? One more time. וחיה אחת עולה למעלה מן השרפים ויורדת על משכן הנער ששמו מטטרון ואומרת בקול גדול, קול דממה דקה, זך כתפי הכבוד. מיד שותקים המלאכים ודוממים עירים וקדישים חשים ודחופים לנהר בינו והחיות נותנות פניהם לארץ והנער הזה ששמו מטטרון מביא אש חרישית ונותן באוזני החיות כדי שלא ישמעו את הקול הדובר של הקדוש ברוך הוא ואת השם המפורש שהנער ששמו מטטרון מזכיר באותה שעה בשבעה חולות. Of the youth named Metatron and said in a loud voice, voice of stillness, pure is the throne of glory. Immediately all the angels are quiet and the holy ones are silent and the angels are running to the river of fire and the holy creatures are prostrating themselves and the youth called Metatron bring loud fire to the ears of the holy creatures so they will not hear the speaking voice of the holy one blessed be he. And the ineffable name that the youth named Metatron is calling at that time in 7 voices. So the youth is calling in his holy, pure, living name, his glorious name, tremendous, beloved name, I am who I am, the eternal name forever and ever, that is my name forever and ever. The last sentence in Hebrew. והנער הזה ששמו מטטרון מביא אש חרישית ונותן באוזני החיות כדי שלא ישמעו את הקול הדובר של הקדוש ברוך הוא ואת השם המפורש שהנער ששמו מטטרון מזכיר באותה שעה בשבעה קולות. ונמצא הנער קורא בשמו which we know now that this is really the Yom Kippur. Now, we realize that this text is what? What is it like?
Hard to understand.
Hard to understand? What else?
Well, I mean, I was talking from some of your yeah, it seems like the first 500 followers are considered here at the time. And then he seems like he's paying back to the Holy Priest.
Yes, he's definitely acting as the Holy Priest. He's definitely described as, in what language? In a present perfect language. As far as they are concerned, as far as they are concerned, the holy sacred worship is going on in heaven. Although there is no worship on earth after the year 70, in the mystical writing, the holy worship is going on. The high priest, named now Hanok Makaton, is officiating, and he's doing what the priest used to do in the Day of Atonement in the Holy of Holies. Calling God's name, saying the Shema Forash, not allowing others to listen. All of that is taking place in heaven. Yes.
Is there not any issue of that?
I can't hear you,
Whoever Hanok Sangeret was, for sure he was not then adult.
No, he is the part of the first fathers of the world, who is the beginning of the pre-Diluvian
understood.
Priesthood. Yes.
But isn't there a contradiction that once we have the name Hanok as a priest, and anyone other than a priest, that satisfies tradition at all?
Well, we have only what we have. The priest that they choose, the heavenly priest that they choose, is not a human among the Hanok, it's the biblical Enoch, who is known to us that was taken to heaven while he was alive. And by now you know, those of you who wrote papers on Hanok, you know what was the central place, how central he is in the tradition of the Bnei Tzadok. For them, no human who is officiating in heaven. It's a human being that was taken to heaven by God in order to be seated in the Enochian, in the paradisal, priestly, heavenly temple. He is the one who officiates on heaven. All the rest are officiating on earth, in their mind, or in a temple, or in a community of Mikdash Kodesh, but not in heaven. Those who officiate in heaven are Hanok ben Yair, who is known as Makaton, and the angels around him. All of that is a priestly orientated literature, but not exclusively priestly. That's the point that I want to make. It is definitely has priestly orientation. It's definitely about high priest serving. It's definitely about angels and priests and all that. But it's not exclusively priestly. If Hanok and Ishmael and Akiva are part of a world in heaven and in earth, it's not only priestly. It is priestly and sacred together. Now we are testing here something very interesting, which we should take into consideration. Even if we don't understand every word, and even if we understand it hard, we do understand that there is overlapping between the sages written tradition and the Halachot written tradition. Whatever we make of it, who to for whom, I don't want to make any suggestion right now, but we do pay attention to the fact that the portion that we wrote from the portion that we read, the one who starts the Elehem Shemesh Nesula Kardes, this is a well-known sages tradition. The four who enter paradise. The same tradition is introduced here. The one about Ganah HaZemachatron, this is not a sages tradition, but this is a continuation of what could have been introduced in the Talmud. Because if we would take a look, what's the common denominator to the two sections that we just now read? Who is in common there? Hanok Makaton. However, in the first tradition, the one who starts the Elohim Kenneth Masula Pazot, in the third line from the bottom, when we are told about Elisha bin Abuya, it says here, אמרו שירד אלישע למרכבה, ראה למטטרון שניתנה לו רשות שעה אחת ביום לשבת לכתוב זכויות של ישראל. בישאת אלישע בנהויה, but before he כיתת בנהיות, was an important thing. Important enough to be among the party that went up to heaven or descended to the church. אמרו שירד אלישע למרכבה, ראה למטטרון שנתנה לו רשות שעה אחת ביום לשב ולכתוב זכויות אל ישראל. I'm sorry?
הוא מראה למטטרון שיש לו
זכויות? לא. אמרו שירד אלישע למרכבה, ראה למטטרון. He had been shown. הוא ראה את מטטרון.
ראה שם מטטרון.
כן, זה יכול להיות שם, כן. כתוב שם לה, אבל זה יכול להיות שם. ראה את מטטרון, או ראה למטטרון, שניתנה לו רשות שעה אחת. The one who was given an hour to sit and write is מטטרון. ראה מטטרון שניתנה לו רשות שעה אחת ביום לשב ולכתוב זכויות של ישראל. He's a heavenly scribe, but now what he's doing, he's writing the rights of Israel, right? This מטטרון. אמר, when he saw the sitting being, writing the right of Israel. אמר, שנו חכמים, למעלה אין עמידה ואין ישיבה. When he's ascending to heaven, he is repeating the sages' tradition which claimed that in heaven there is no sitting. In heaven they are probably, they are hovering with wings or something, but they're not supposed to sit. So then he says, in heaven, why? Because he sees an angel who is sitting. In heaven, שם שתי רשויות יש בשמיים. Are there two powers in heaven? That's what Elisha is saying. Are there two powers in heaven? The immediate response to that thought of Elisha, מיד הוציא למטטרון לחוץ לפרגול, והיכור 60 קולטי דנוע. מטטרון, who doesn't do anything, but sitting and write the rights of Israel, as he was supposed to do, is being punished on account of Elisha's thought.
And what was he arrived at now? Is there a whole lot of anti-Christology, so to mention that Matashon took place משהו שהוא בשדר, מטטרון עבר מצב שיכול להיות שדר לה השם במקום ככה, אז זה כאילו מנגד לעמדה that is, it seems to be that they're punishing Matatron for taking the key to God.
Well, we don't know anything about what Matatron is thinking. We know what Matatron is doing. He has been a heavenly scribe from the very beginning. As we read together last week, Enoch is introduced as a heavenly scribe, and we saw numerous examples of it. The word writing and scribe and just scribe and holy scribe and all that, that was his immanent identity. When Elisha is ascending to heaven in this tradition, and he sees Matatron sitting, Matatron sitting and writing as he was supposed to do.
That's not the scribal part of the Bible.
Well, of course, however, in order to write, you need to sit usually. But he says, whatever is the connection, it's obvious not what Matatron is thinking. We're not told what Matatron is thinking. We are told what Elisha is thinking. And Elisha is thinking, שם השתי רשויות יש בשמיים. The response to that is to show him, to demonstrate him, that he is not an independent power. מיד הוציאו למטטרון לחוץ לפרגול, והיכו 60 קולטי דנוע. Immediately, מטטרון was taken out and being beaten with 60 lashes of fire. And then the end of the story, רבי עקיבא עלה בשלום וירד בשלום. Who is telling this story? Rabbi Akiva is the one who is telling this story. Who is getting out of the story with an upper hand? Rabbi Akiva is the one, he's the only one out of the whole court who went in and out, who nichnas b'shalom v'yata b'shalom. On whom this particular saying is known to us. Al mi ne'emar yata b'shalom. במסכת יומא, על כהן גדול שיוצא מקודש הקודשים, כתוב, יצא בשלום. וכתוב, יום טוב היה עושה הכהן לאוהביו, שנכנס לשלום ויצא בשלום. It's the same word about יצא בשלום. Elsewhere, you know, אתה נכנס ויוצא. There's no reason to say נכנס בשלום ויצא בשלום. Only to depart yet and to קודש הקודשים, when the priestly ascent is taking place, we are told that Nichnas v'yatza b'shalom. Here, the Parges is also considered like the priestly sacred presence, where it's very dangerous. And one is Nichnas v'shalom and Yotze b'shalom, because it could be otherwise. It could be that one is not entering in peace, nor departing in peace. So here, definitely, the only one who enters and departs in peace is Rabbi Yosef.